You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is episode 8. It's a new series, and we're raring to go. Here in STS, we've got some extraordinary PhD students. In this first episode of our new series, you get to meet one. Gemma Milne is a PhD student here in STS. She already is a well-established science and technology writer. Gemma researches the ethics of innovation, both in the lab and in the marketplace. I talk with Gemma about how she got interested in STS and what are some of the big ideas she sees influencing her work. But I also brought Gemma in for another special reason. She's author of the recent book, Smoke and Mirrors, How Hype Obscures the Future and How to See Past It. This book's a great example of STS and how it can be applied in fields of technology innovation. And as luck would have it, Smoke and Mirrors also is this year's STS One book. Each year, we ask everyone in our community to read one book together. We explore how that book gives us common ground and gets us all thinking. So in the first half of the podcast, I talk with Gemma about her book and how it applies in today's hype-friendly world. In the second part of the podcast, we talk about Gemma, how she got started, and how she moved from being a maths undergraduate into being an STS scholar. So lots to do today. Let's get going. I begin, as always, by asking our guest to introduce themselves.
Hello, everyone. I'm Gemma Milne. I'm a writer, a broadcaster, and a researcher here at UCL in the STS department. I guess a way to sort of encapsulate all the different pieces of work that I do is that I'm pretty obsessed with how the world works, and specifically how science and technology intersect with society and how they shape and are shaped by the world around them. And that's always been the sort of project of what I get up to.
Brilliant. Now, Gemma, we're going to talk a lot about you and a lot about your background in the second half of this conversation, but let's focus down on your recent book. Last year, during the pandemic, you published this fantastic book titled Smoke and Mirrors. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So Smoke and Mirrors is all about the role that hype plays in the world of science and technology. So how do we talk about science and technology? What sort of headlines are out there? What sort of promises are being made about science and tech by various different kinds of people? And originally the book was kind of being pitched as this sort of hype busting book. So, you know, I would read headlines about science tech and I'd get really frustrated and go, that's not really what it's about. And they're misleading people and it's not really a lie. It's kind of just an exaggeration and it's complicated and people don't get it. But as I started researching it more and kind of trying to bring together that sort of narrative, and I go into all different kinds of science and technologies to bring examples about that, about hype, so everything from space to AI to cancer therapeutics to food, I realized that actually hype plays a much more interesting role than just exaggerating things and bringing attention to stuff. It really does sort of shape the direction of the development of technology, and sometimes it has arguably a positive role, sometimes a negative role. And so as with most things, the more you look into them, it's more complicated and more interesting than originally it might seem. So Smoke and Mirrors is kind of the end of that journey of years of thinking about hype. You give a bit of context as well. I've had many different kinds of jobs that sort of feed into my interest in hype. You know, I worked in the advertising industry, which is, you know, the industry that literally runs on hype and produces hype. And I've also worked in investment banking and you know, the team that I worked with is the one that takes companies public and floats them on the stock market. And they have to make the case for these companies and get investors excited. So hype was a big part of that role. And then also being a journalist, you know, I'm receiving pitches from companies and people all the time who want me to write about them. So they are hyping themselves up. But of course, my job as a journalist is to try and sift through that hype and try and make sense of it. So hype has been a part of my career, my interest for a long time. And I suppose that's why it ended up being this much more complicated and interesting picture of essentially how hype plays in the world, as opposed to just why it's this bad thing that we need to bust.
That's fantastic. I'll tell you how I got drawn into your book, okay? And this will help explain, I think, a little bit more about what's inside the book. When I first opened it up, I thought, okay, this is a science and technology journalist who's going to tell me about new science and new technology. Mm. And so I just kind of crack open a chapter and just sort of look through it. And there's a lot of stuff about what's on the cutting edge right now. And I thought, this is great. And then you hooked me on the other thing, which is the thing the book seems to be really about, which is about hype and that concept of hype. And you hooked me and then you threw me in quite a different direction. And it was, okay, when I kind of concentrated on the fact that you were going to tell me how hype exists in the new science and new technology world, I thought, okay, you're going to tell me that there's hype everywhere. And I know that. This is where you threw me. And you said, hang on, Joe, it's more complicated than that. And I just love it when people say that. When it's more complicated, I love that idea that you just said. There can be good hype and there can be bad hype. So let's focus on hype and tell us a little bit more.
Sure. So maybe I'll start with a bit of analogy, which ties into why the book's called Smoke and Mirrors in the first place. So for anyone who doesn't know, smoke and mirrors is kind of like a term that's used to talk about, you know, hype or messages or whatever that hide something behind them. And it derives from the title of a magic trick that comes from like the 1700s. And it's where magicians would essentially use a combination of smoke and mirrors, and they would sort of beam images that would sort of look like they were coming out of boxes, like ghosts, for instance. And obviously in the 1700s, these things tricked people a lot more than nowadays. Of course, we know how these tricks work and probably are a little more skeptical about these sorts of things to some degree. So this concept of magic and performance was something that I was thinking a lot about when I was thinking about hype. So you can think about hype through the lens of magic by considering this. If you go to a magic show, right, and you walk into the theatre, you're essentially, by walking into that room, consenting to be fooled. So you're saying to the magician, it's absolutely okay for you to try and trick me. I might sit here and just enjoy the show. I might try and work it out and spot the sleight of hand. But either way, I am consenting. It's absolutely fine for you to try and trick me. When someone lies to you, that would be non-consensual fooling. So you're not, you know, saying it's okay for you to fool me. You don't maybe even know what's happening and so on and so forth. Hype. It's not misinformation or fake news. That would be lying. That would be, you know, non-consensual fooling. Hype is the tool that is used to capture people's attention. And it's not a tool for understanding. So therefore, sometimes there's not enough information in there for you to really get what's at the crux of it. And therefore, sometimes hype can result in what I think of as accidental fooling. So it sits in between this kind of consensual, non-consensual fooling where you don't necessarily know what's happening to you, but the person who's doing it isn't necessarily trying to fool you in the first place. So you have to come back to this point that hype is a tool purely for capturing attention, to get you to stop scrolling on your phone, or to, you know, if you see something at a bus stop, to then go on your phone and look it up, or to listen to someone who's trying to tell you about their political messaging or whatever it might be. It's not there to actually give you the picture of what something is. So when you have that understanding of what hype is, in the sense that it's not this dastardly thing, and it's also not just, you know, the thing that happens in fashion with the drops and the hype, the good hype, the interesting hype around trends, suddenly you start to see it as this thing that you kind of have to play with if you're working in a field that requires some form of attention. And science and technology absolutely requires some form of attention, whether it's bringing out a new product that you have to try and sell in the market, whether it's trying to get funding for a new piece of research that you're doing, whether it's, you know, going into schools and teaching people about the ways of the world. You have to somehow capture attention and get people to listen to you. And hype is a tool that does that. So this is what I mean about thinking about things as slightly more complicated. You have to work out why does it even exist in the world in the first place, and how do people use it? it makes it a kind of more interesting concept that instead of just being a bad thing, you also then start thinking, well, what does it mean to use hype in a responsible way? When is it okay to use hype? When is it justified to use hype? You might say that using hype to get across, for instance, like a public health message, like, you know, smoking is bad for you, for instance, you could argue that's a justified use of hype if you made a really, you know, fascinating advert or you made big claims or so on and so forth. Whereas using hype to sell a product that's not that great to people that don't have very much money, that don't need it, and they feel tricked, then I would say that's a very bad use of hype. So, but it's, there's a gray zone in the middle. Like, is it okay to sell, I don't know, iPhones? I mean, they're not necessarily good things, they're not necessarily bad things. And is the selling of them ethical? And it's these kind of questions that I try and explore in the book with respect to all these different areas of science and tech.
Right. I mean, what I really like about that is you differentiate, by differentiating between good hype and bad hype, you really, and on one side, you really raise the alert level, I think, for a viewer of hype. Mm. And at the same time, you give us a vocabulary to talk about things that aren't always bad.
Right.
Or, and also to think about ways they can be useful. An example, a public health message about COVID, right? Mm. Go outside and you're going to die. That sounds like terrible hype. But there's a certain moment where it sounds like that's not bad advice. That's pretty useful direction, I think, for people. So Gemma, one of the things I think is really fantastic about your analysis is it feels so STS. And in focusing on hype as a sociological process, you really draw in the STS conversation. So not just talking about hype being good or bad, but asking the question, how does it function? Mm-hmm. And you give some really good examples in your book about how hype functions, as though you're the anthropologist or sociologist standing in the corner watching it happen. Mm. Maybe you can give us an example.
Okay, so the hyped up narrative or headline that probably most of you will have heard before is robots are going to steal our jobs. You've probably seen it in, you know, a magazine. You probably heard people talk about it. Maybe you've gone to dinner and someone talks about robots and someone said, oh, they're going to steal our jobs, right? So this is a very common narrative that is used to talk about the concept of automation, right? So when we say robots are going to steal our job, what we really mean is, you know, people are going to be replaced by automated processes in some sense. However, using the words and the meanings and the feelings around this headline, shall we say, robots are going to steal our jobs, you pull in all different kinds of stuff. So for instance, when you say robots are going to steal our job, you're othering, right? You're saying it's this thing that isn't human, that's separate, that's coming towards us. You know, interestingly enough, it's a very similar narrative that's used to talk about immigration a lot of time, you know, people coming to steal our jobs. They are coming to steal our jobs. It's very much an us and them kind of analogy. This idea of stealing, it's seen as this thing that's our right, that's being taken away, and so on and so forth. So of course, this sort of headline provokes fear, perhaps anger, but it's very much you're projected towards the technology, the robot, this thing that's maybe not even existing right now, but maybe only in the future. Whereas if you take the same idea of automation, i.e. people being replaced by automated processes, and instead you write a headline or you use the hype, corporate CEOs are making active decisions to replace human labor with machines in the name of profit. Suddenly you have this entirely different wording that brings out completely different feelings and I would also assume actions from those that it reaches. For instance, it's probably going to make you rethink who has power, for instance, right? Or it's maybe going to change the way you might vote, or maybe it's going to make you rethink your own job and the CEO that you work for, or look at the CEOs out there who are blatantly doing this versus the ones that are maybe hiding it in the name of profit. It makes you think about capitalism. Like, there's so much, not necessarily more in that, but a very different kind of reaction to arguably the same thing, in the sense that they're both about automation. It's just a very different way of presenting it. And that, you know, that's where the sort of emotional power and the sort of, you know, sounds like a basic thing to say, words matter, the pen is mightier than the sword, but it's that power within hype that allows it to propagate, that has it spread, because it sort of feasts on certain kinds of emotions. I mean, another one for the robots are going to steal your job. Suddenly you have this idea of a robot consciously doing that. You could start up a conversation about whether or not robots, think or are conscious, right? Whereas again, the corporate CEO one might create a completely different dinner party conversation around Marxism. So that's one example of just showing how exactly what you said about how hype sort of functions in society. And going back to what I said at the beginning about what I'm so obsessed with, it's like how the world works. How is it that we end up talking about certain things or taking certain actions with this sort of invisible or soft stuff that feels like it's in between everything else flowing through society?
Yeah, and in that example about the will robots take our jobs, you so nicely ask the question, you know, who's making the decision here? Who's mm-hmm. acting? And it's not the robots, it's somebody else. And the value of hype is it obscures, it's the smoke right. and mirrors. It obscures who's actually making these decisions and why. One of the ways that got reinforced for me is in your writing style in this book, where you got this really nice part in the conclusion where you say, look, I don't want to do this, but I know some people want it. So I'm going to give you the bullet points.
Yes.
I'm glad
you noticed that bit, because a lot of people don't pick up on that. So I'm glad to hear you got that, Joe.
Yeah, it's like, I don't want to do this, but here it is. So take it. And so bang, bang, bang. And one of the things you say is hype obscures complexity. Mm-hmm. And to me, the robot stealing our jobs is a really great example, because it looks really simple. But in fact, you know, the action is taking place on a much more complex level. And if we're going to sit around a room arguing about robots, I think your point is that we're having the wrong argument. We need to shift to somewhere else. Did I capture you correctly?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, 100%. I mean, not necessarily the wrong argument. I mean, I think if it's the only one, though, that's where it's problematic. I mean, yes, should we be arguing about robots and consciousness? Yeah, why not? I mean, that's an important discussion that many, many scholars are looking at, also in STS, right? But I think the point is that if that's the dominant conversation and the one that we keep coming back to as the only example of ethics in AI, for instance, then we're missing a lot of stuff. And I think what you said there about hype obscuring complexity, that absolutely is why I hope people kind of leave my book with, is this feeling that, you know, complexity is, it sounds like a simple thing to say, but complexity is the reality of life and society and the world that we live in. And if we try and get away from complexity and try and find simple answers and try and find the bottom line, which a lot of time is what hype is doing, it's sort of giving you this this quick kind of angle or something like that, you're missing the story. You're missing what's really going on beneath the surface. And we have to be so much more comfortable with complexity if we actually want to understand and therefore take action or whatever it is we want to do in the world. And, you know, the other bit that I put in the conclusion that I think is really linked to that and is pertinent is the biggest hype of all is that science is too complicated for us to engage with. Science and tech is this thing that only people that study it can possibly understand, that only people with PhDs have the right to talk about, only people who do hard science as opposed to social science or so on and so forth are clever around and therefore are allowed to talk about. That's the biggest hype and that's the biggest obscuring force, because it's literally stopping people from engaging. You know, I studied maths at uni, and whenever I tell people this, they go, God, you must be so clever. I was terrible at maths at school. Or they go, oh my God, I studied maths as well, and then be like nerd out about prime numbers. But the point I'm making here is there's this massive barrier just by saying maths. And it's the same, you see it over and over again. I'm sure you see it as well, Joe, like when you talk about what your job is, a lot of people feel quite afraid about engaging with science and tech. And as we know in STS, that's when things go wrong, when you don't have democratic participation, when you don't have the insight of all different kinds of fields coming together to help make decisions, to push people in different directions and push technologies in different directions, and instead rely on only people with certain kind of siloed thinking or deterministic thinking and so on and so forth. So it's really about wrestling with complexity, but then also feeling comfortable with it and empowered. And understanding hype, I think, is one of, if not the best way of doing that.
That's really fantastic. We always say in STS, of course, that there's more to science than scientists. And,
right.
and I think you've nicely demonstrated that in your book. And you cover 9 different subjects, mm-hmm. really, in the book. You really cover a fantastic range of new and emerging science and technologies. Do you have a favorite of those chapters, a favorite subject?
Ooh, it's like asking me, which is my favorite child, Joe? there's technologies that I think are more complicated and therefore in my mind are more interesting, because I find complex stories really fascinating. So I find fusion really interesting, for instance. And then there's chapters that I found more interesting to write because I felt like I was having to wrestle with a bit more, particularly from an emotional standpoint. So for instance, the cancer chapter was like a real, shall we say, literary challenge in making sure that I was writing about the science and technology well, the societal points as well, the politics, but also appreciating that people reading this will most likely have been touched by cancer in some sense. So, you know, again, that there's more to science than the scientists, right? That was an interesting challenge. But I think my favorite chapter and my favorite one that I suppose I focused on, and I was really excited to put it in a book like this, and I think it probably caught people by surprise, was the astrobiology chapter, which is the final one. Because it allowed me, I felt like it allowed me to be a bit ethereal and a bit more philosophical and slightly, pair big thinking and a little bit more speculative thinking and wonder and awe, which at the end of the day is the thing that got me into science and tech in the first place, into what I hope is some intriguing, interesting, and quite important stuff about, the human condition, as well as, you know, the actual experiments that we're doing to try and work out whether or not there's life on Mars. And I think, you know, most people kind of, I suppose, like yourself, you know, you picked up and thought this is going to be about future tech. So of course there'll be an AI chapter. Of course there'll be something about, you know, electric cars. I don't think people assume that there's going to be something about finding life on other planets. So that was fun.
On the news yesterday, it was the most beautiful example of hype in astrobiology, which was a story that ran about there. Scientists say there are 27 possible Earth-like planets that could observe us.
Oh, you know? Interesting. Okay.
You think, what a framing. Yeah.
There's a lot there.
It's like CCTV from UFOs, you know. Anyway, it was a beautiful. Anybody who's listening to this podcast, look up that story and ask yourself, how is it hype? And then go back and read Gemma's chapter on astrobiology and see how you can put those two pieces together.
Well, I mean, it's particularly because in that chapter, I talk a lot about all the, if you allow yourself to kind of for a second take life on other planets seriously, you essentially are allowed to ask really fascinating questions. So when you're talking about observing us, right, getting past the hype in the sense of, you know, we know what they're trying to do with that headline. But actually when you start thinking about it, it's like, what do they mean by observing? Is that like to do with the distance? Is it to do with like the particular atmosphere that they have, which means they can quote unquote see us somehow? What are they using to see us? What does it mean to see? You know, do they have eyes? Are they using some kind of like infrared thing going on? Do they have to be conscious in order to understand what it means to see? There's like so many questions that pop up just from that word, that observe or that see. And again, that's why I think this particular area is such a fascinating one. And I think it illustrates why when you really allow yourself to get past the hype in all areas of science and tech, you're not just then opening up the hood of a car and working out what the mechanics are. You're asking anthropological, political, sociological, and philosophical questions, which are really interesting and fun. You know, hype is not just about being critical. It's also about getting under the hood and then really getting to grips with stuff that's quite fascinating.
Oh, your inner sociologist is coming out. This is fantastic. I'll tell you my favorite chapter, which is, and it's going to make an important link to another part of STS. And I'm going to argue that you're actually there's a historian of technology in you anxious to come out. Okay.
Okay. Okay.
Follow this line of argument. So one of the things you say about hype is it isolates a particular bit of information like robots rather than work and the economy or something like that. And all throughout your book, when you're talking about, any subjects, but particularly in the chapter on batteries, you stress over and over again the importance of not thinking about the individual piece of technology, but focusing on the system as a whole, what that piece goes into. The battery goes into the car goes on the road, there needs to be charging points and power stations and all that stuff. And you come back and say, the we need to think about technological systems more than bits of technology. And what hype does is it takes us in the reverse. We focus on the piece rather than the whole, right? So that's one of your big lines of argument about sociology of technology. And while I was reading that, I thought, I've heard this before. And I went back and I was looking around, and there's a really classic piece of history of technology written in the 1970s about the electrification of America. And it's written by a historian who was so mad about being asked all the time about the invention of the light bulb. And so he went off and wrote a book and said, light bulbs go into sockets. Sockets are tied to wires. Wires have electricity going through them. Generating plants create the electricity, and on and on and on. And he basically said, if you don't know about the system, you don't know about the technology. And it strikes me, this is where your inner historian of technology is coming out, Gemma, I think. And that is, I think you're taking that argument and you're not only are you applying it as a sociologist would apply it, but you're also taking it into the next generation. You're really, really expanding that systems building argument. Okay, so that's the lecture. What do you reckon? Does that sound like there's any connection?
Sure. Do you know, and I think it's interesting you say this, because, and this is a little bit of a side point. I was explaining to you earlier, you know, I came into STS after I'd written the book, and I must admit, I've been very like, you know, I'm not an academic, I'm a journalist or a writer, you know, oh gosh, I need to learn the methods of how to do academic stuff, right? And sociology felt like the one closest tie to what I'd already done. And I must admit, history, in some sense, I'm like, I would love to be a historian of science technology, but I'm like, I don't know how you be a historian, because I don't, I've never done it before. And I must admit, I've got very much a lot of imposter syndrome there. So first of all, thank you for saying that, because that gives me lots of confidence. But I think also I am very interested in the history of science and tech. And actually, the fusion chapter was one of the reasons I loved writing that chapter, was because it was diving into the history of fusion. It wasn't just there as a nice intro to the chapter, like, this is where it comes from. It's crucial to understand the movement over time, and as you say, the system around this technology over time, not just now, in order to understand why things happen right now. And specifically with fusion, it's this this sort of narrative of it's going to be 50 years away. It's kind of a joke, right? And a lot of that is based on historical perceptions of failure, and the fact that it was seen as pseudoscience for some time, and the fact that there's actually some quite hilarious stories about fraudsters that fusion is so tied to. So this idea of like joking and comedy and failure and so on and so forth is very built in to the story of fusion's development as a technology. And, you know, it's not enough to only talk about it now to make that narrative make sense. You have to give the context of what came before. And, you know, for me, that was just a fun thing to do, but I'm going to take your point as a professor and say, cool, that must mean that I should probably look into this a bit more as an academic.
Or conversely, you don't need to at all, because you got it and you're taking it to the next level. I think that's the exciting bit about it.
I'll take that.
So Gemma, news has just come around this week that your book has been selected as the STS One book. So first of all, congratulations.
Thank you. I was so flattered.
Yeah. So the STS One book is a program where we ask everybody in the department, the students, the staff, the honoraries, the visitors, everybody who comes through to read one book. And we do that because we think it has something in common with a lot of parts of STS as a subject, but also it serves as a common ground for conversation. So we've covered why it's a great example of science journalism and of sociology of science and of science policy and even a bit of history. But is there something specific you want to say to the students and the staff who are going to read this as part of the One Book program? Would you like to give them some advice on how to push ahead with that?
And one of the things I really tried to do with Smoke and Mirrors was work out, if I was to try and explain the whole world of cancer therapeutics to someone, what are the sort of like nodes of the system that I would have to touch on in order for them to build their own map off the back of. So I got inspired by this book called The Theoretical Minimum, which is actually a book that sort of teaches you how to do physics, right? It's like, what is the theoretical minimum of physics that you would need to know in order to then go on and enjoy reading about physics and doing physics. And so I that's what I was always thinking with each chapter, is like, what's the theoretical minimum of this stuff that not only allows someone to, you know, essentially read a Wikipedia page and get the gist of it, but actually to then read a news item and engage with it and feel that they maybe could have an opinion, or they could maybe show up at a conference and kind of get the gist of what's going on, and not fake, not in a sort of fake knowledge, kind of fake it till you make it kind of way, but in a way that feels engaging. And I suppose that's maybe what I always try and hope that people get out of Smoke and Mirrors, and instead of necessarily trying to find the answer to what hype is or a how-to guide on how to spot hype, rather let it be a sort of practice on how to think about the systems and how to tell stories of systems. And, you know, maybe after you've read the book or even just one chapter, think of something that you're interested in and then think, what would be the theoretical minimum of this field or this area or this sport or this TV program or whatever it is? How would I map it in such a way that I could tell someone that has never come across it before or has only maybe heard about it or has some assumptions about it or preconceived ideas, and allow them to kind of get it in a way that's enlightening, that's inspiring, that makes them excited, and crucially allows them to engage. That would be my little, I suppose, call to arms. What's the theoretical minimum of something you're interested in?
I'm going to interrupt here. Let's take a short break. Let's get back to my interview with Gemma Milne. So Gemma, how did you come to be interested in STS as a topic?
Well, I suppose it's quite a funny story. When I finished writing the first, I think it was the first or second draft of Smoke and Mirrors, so it was with my publisher getting edited, so it was done. I wasn't really allowed to make any other changes other than, you know, spelling errors and things like this. Somebody put me in touch with Jack Stilgo, Dr. Jack Stilgo, who's in the department here at UCL as well. And they said, oh, he's written this book on self-driving cars and he has a chapter on hype. You should read it because you've written a book about hype. So I messaged Jack and I was like, hi, I hear you have this book and you have this chapter about hype, and here's a PDF of my book if you're interested in it. Can you trade me? And he sent me his chapter. And I was like, oh my goodness, I can't believe I haven't come across this stuff before, because Jack's chapter is sort of really centered on the STS literature around hype. So the sort of academic publications on it. I mean, he writes it not in a deeply academic way, but he draws on the literature that's there that, frankly, I didn't even know existed. And, my first thought was, oh God, I can't believe I haven't put this in my book. I can't believe I hadn't come across this, and so on and so forth. But then my second thought was, I need to get to know what on earth this guy studies and how he's ended up doing this and where all this comes from. So we met up and I asked him about what he did, and he told me about the department. He told me about the field, and I then, you know, went on the internet and downloaded the Handbook of Science and Technology Studies and started reading it, Introduction to STS and all these sorts of things. And I was just completely taken by it. I was like, this is an incredible field that feels like it's speaking my language, but then equally there's so much here that I feel like I haven't heard of that I really want to learn. But it also gives frameworks and words to stuff that I think is hard to describe sometimes. And for me, particularly as a writer and as somebody who's been trying to wrestle with a lot of issues in science and tech, and always saying, you know, I try and bring in society to science and tech, not realizing I could have just gone and found it in this academic discipline. When I'm writing about things like you know, science and politics are linked. I didn't realize there was this whole thing called, like, you know, co-production that's been at the center of the STS for years. And so I think there's a lot of things about STS that excited me in the sense that it helped me give words to stuff, but equally it was also like, wow, this feels like a massive platform and a jumping off point to a lot of things I'm very interested in that the field just hasn't had time to look at yet, and there's not enough people doing it. So it felt like a very exciting opportunity, despite the fact I felt very humbled to begin with from that sort of goodness, how have I not heard of stuff that's quite inherent to this entire book that I've written on the topic.
Yeah. So one of the things I'm hearing you say, Gemma, is that coming into an academic unit like STS, it's not just putting fancy names on the things that you see all the time, but it's thinking about the subjects that other scholars have worked on. It's encouraging you to sort of expand your own mind.
Definitely. Yeah, no, I mean, it's not just about, I mean, I think sometimes academia in general can get a bad rap for that. It's like, oh, there's this, you know, concept in society or in science or whatever, and they've given it this Latin name and now it's inaccessible. Well, yes, if you're looking at it from a sort of shallow standpoint, you could argue that that is what academia does to some degree. But I think if you take a step back and realize that actually giving a name to thing, then produces inspiration for a lot of other people to go, oh, that thing, yes, I've been thinking about it too. Here are my thoughts. And then someone else going, do you know what? You've actually said something that I think is linked to this thing over here in this other field. And now I can link this term with this one. And it's almost like a, I don't know, a network building effect, shall we say. So that's what I find really exciting. I'll come across a term, like I've been really interested in performativity recently, for instance. And, you know, obviously I've wrote a book about hype and I'm sort of saying that hype makes stuff happen, which is kind of the same idea as performativity to some degree. And again, I didn't know that that was that what that term meant in an academic sense. And now I've discovered this whole body of literature and performativity, not just in science, tech, but in economics and law and all different areas, that gives me a whole different way to think about the stuff that I'm interested in, and allows my brain to kind of make more connections and more thoughts, and sometimes overwhelmingly so. But for me, that's kind of the excitement of when you really kind of get your hands dirty with academic literature and try your best to get over the sort of perhaps the imposter syndrome or whatever it is, that when it can feel so complicated or inaccessible, it's like, no, just take a step back. What is it they're actually trying to say? What's the purpose of giving a word for this? What's the opportunity in giving a word for this or a framework for this? Or yeah, it's kind of a flourishing effect, I suppose.
Some people think it's a secret that we shouldn't let out, that we actually are fully engaged in all kinds of stuff. But let me turn to ask you a careers kind of question. Mm-hmm. So you said before that you studied mathematics at university. So how does the Gemma of a mathematics student as an undergraduate, how did you become the Gemma that you are today? What's the path?
I have always been interested in, I guess, communicating awe and communicating wonder and trying to get people to feel how I feel about things I'm interested in. And I've always been interested in math specifically. Like I have a necklace around my neck, which has pi on it, because I think pi is just totally fascinating in so many different ways. I've always been interested in patterns and prime numbers, in the sort of, for any mathematicians who are listening to this, the kind of the penny drop moments that you get in maths where you just get it and you're like, mind blown. How does that even work? Like Euler's theorem, when you like first understand it, it's so beautiful. And so I really want everybody to feel like that about Euler's theorem and to feel like that about maths. And from a young age, I've always been, particularly my mom, I've been trying to convince her how beautiful and stunning maths is. She studied zoology at university. She's a writer, so she and a counselor, so she, I suppose, would put herself more in the arts and all that sort of thing. And she's always been like, nah, maths is not for me. And I've always been like, no, it's beautiful. It's stunning. It's got all these bits to it. So that's something that's kind of always been there for me. And when I went to study maths, frankly, I was actually quite disappointed. Like I was expecting to kind of have all these penny drop moments and these beauty moments. I mean, I studied pure maths. I didn't do applied maths. I hate statistics and calculus and all that, but I love all my prime numbers and my Greek letters. And it made sense for me afterwards to seek out more of that wonderful stuff, shall we say, the awe. And you know, I got captured to some degree by the banks. You know, the banks came up to my university and were trying to recruit math students because obviously they love math students. And I worked in investment banking. I managed 3 months. I was like, this is so not for me. But I loved London and I loved the kind of the city life. I grew up in a village. So, you know, obviously the sort of cliche, I love the city. And so I basically was like, well, how can I pair London with the more creative, amazing side of things that I think is really awesome and step away from maths for a little while? And that's how I ended up in advertising. I Googled creative business jobs, London, and I ended up in advertising. But then when I was there, I realized I was missing science and tech and I was missing maths. And so, you know, I ended up then moving into a job that paired all of that, and I ended up in a thing called innovation. So I was what's called a tech innovation strategist, and my job was to go find startups and interesting innovation, quote unquote, people all around the world and connect them up with the company that I worked for. So that was when I kind of finally got to do a bit of the intersection of both. And when I was in that job, I did a lot of like speaking on behalf of the company, you know, like kind of thought leadership stuff. And, you know, I was getting good at it and people kind of liked the way I did it. So they started to give me free rein about what I could speak about. And I was like, well, I'm going to speak about maths. I'm going to tell people why maths is really interesting. And I'm going to somehow tie it back to the advertising industry and innovation in advertising or something like that. It was all about like what makes people tick. And if you can really get to the crux of what makes people tick and why something's exciting, no matter how boring it might seem on the outside, that's when you can kind of use interesting narratives and so on and so forth. So I had this talk that was all about Euler's theorem and about the wonder of maths. And you know, I had a lot of people sort of coming up to me at the end being like, do you work as, you know, a science communicator or like a journalist, or do you do anything that I can go read? And I'm like, no, I just work in advertising and sometimes I do some talks. But at that point, that was when the penny started dropping that, you know, perhaps maybe I had a talent for it, and started a podcast with my partner that kind of dived into some of those topics around, you know, I felt so let down by maths and by science and tech, in the sense that I hadn't felt that awe and that amazement, and I hadn't been engaged with the university, and I was like, why is that? And so we, you know, we talked about how to make it better communicated, and then we started talking about topics like how do we actually make academia better, and then it kind of led to all sorts of stuff about incentive structures, and then I started thinking about the system of academia and of science and so on and so forth, and got really excited by that. And around about that time, I then got made redundant from my job. And frankly, was just trying to get any work I possibly could because I was living in London without any money. So I was like, what could I do? And I got hired to write about stuff and did a bit of science teaching at like summer schools. I did a lot of speaking. I did a bit of consulting kind of based off the back of that innovation work I'd done. But the thing that I realized I really liked and that other people liked about me is that I was able to do this communication thing, that I was writing in an interesting way, and I was bringing in all these different sides of me, from the person who's like feels wonder about science and tech, but also who's critical and also who likes to get to grips with the system and how it works and the structures and so on and so forth. And I guess just over time, I really focused in on that and did the book, and then fell into academia because I met an SDSer and thought they were great. So that's where we are today.
And today you have a career that I may unfairly characterize it as a freelance career, but the mm-hmm. way I see it is there are lots of pieces to your working day and your working week. It's some people think of the job that they might have in the future as they work for a company and the company pays them. And in a lot of ways you've done that, but, mm-hmm. but it sounds like another path is to assemble lots of pieces, any of which is challenging and fantastic and rewarding, and occasional pays. Mm-hmm. But also you see that as that's your career. It's to have right. that portfolio or assembly. Do I have that about right?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, that's definitely me. And it has been me for the last, I think I've been freelance now for 6 years. And it's the joy of what I do. I mean, it's like what you said, it's an assemblage or a collection. I pick and choose the things that I like to do, and I work hard to get to do them. You know, they're not handed to me on a plate to some degree, but I think it's about, I mean, when I was made redundant from my job, I did a talk about this not long after, where I realized that I was sort of relying on the headline, like the title of my, you know, tech innovation strategist at Ogilvy & Mather. That's who I was. That's how I introduced myself at parties. That's what was on my you know, Twitter bio and all these sorts of things. And when that was taken away from me, it was like, oh my God, who am I? You know, like quarter life crisis. And, you know, I realized that I wasn't really honing in and giving myself permission to do things that I actually was interested in. I felt, you know, I would go to like events and stuff while I was working in the advertising company, you know, events about like film or about certain sports or whatever. And I'd be thinking, God, just don't let anybody ask me what my job is, because they're going to see that I don't work in the space. I shouldn't be here, you know? And then when you're made redundant, you don't have that issue because you're fun employed. You're in between jobs, you know, so you can do whatever you like and everybody accepts you and they assume that you have a reason to be there and so on and so forth. And they're like that anyway, but I think you put your own limits on yourself. So when I realized how freeing that was, how amazing it was to be able to move in various different spaces and how much I enjoyed 1 minute talking to a nuclear physicist and then the next minute talking to some media person and the next person, next moment talking to someone who works in the publishing industry or whatever, I was like, I can't really go back to only doing one job and only having quote unquote one identity in terms of what I do, not just for a living, but like in my life.
Right. I was gonna ask you if you thought that there was anything that linked all the pieces of that, but I'm gonna give you the worst line to introduce yourself at a party, because I have a theory about what holds all those things together.
Oh, I want to hear it.
Because I don't think it's a lot of pieces. I think it's one thing implemented in lots of different ways, and it comes from the last paragraph of your book, where you politely revise HTULs, mm-hmm. and you basically say the most important thing right now is critical thinking, and so my theory is that that's the thing that holds everything that you're doing together. It's critical thinking, and mm-hmm. and the worst way to introduce yourself at a party, of course, would be, "Hi, I'm Gemma Milne, and I'm a critical thinker." You know,
can you imagine people would not want to hang out with me at parties? I mean, not that I'm the center of parties at the moment, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, so we just have to, you know, everybody listening, maybe help Gemma out and find her Twitter account and send her an idea for how she can introduce herself. Who she's a super critical thinker and taking lots of information and processing it and applying a critical thinking frame on top of it. So however we can help you out, Gemma, that's what we're going
to
do.
Or I would challenge you all to get rid of your very simple way of introducing yourself and think about how else you can put it together like a patchwork or a quilt and see what all the bits are. Because that, as I say, that yes, I think you're right. The critical thinking part certainly is at the center. I always say I'm obsessed with the way the world works. That's the truth of it. And it's not just science and tech. It's frankly anything. I love systems and I love how things are interconnected.
Brilliant. Gemma, I've got one more question for you. Mm-hmm. But before I ask, I'm going to say that we haven't talked at all about your PhD research that you're doing in STS on futurism and ethical futurism. So if we have you back on another show, we can talk about that in full detail.
Is that going to be okay? That would be awesome. Yeah. Once I've gathered more information, I'm only a year in after all.
Got to give you a chance to do the work before you come up with the explanation.
Right, right. Yeah.
Fair enough. The question that I have for you simply is, do you have some advice for students who are maybe thinking about applying to university or students who are at university as they look ahead maybe 1 or 2 years? Do you have any advice you'd like to give to them?
Try and think beyond the subjects that you have at high school. Because when I went to university, it was, well, I'm good at maths at high school. I like maths, so I'm going to go study maths. And I didn't know that sociology existed. I didn't know that philosophy existed. I didn't know that anthropology existed. I didn't know that STS existed because my school didn't offer any of those as a subject, right? So I would encourage you to look through a prospectus and really, you know, look at all these weird and wonderful titles of degrees that you've never heard of. And that doesn't, I'm not necessarily saying going and study one of those, you might not want to, but at least try and take a module in them or something like an elective. Talk to your pals about what they do. I mean, I lived with two psychologists all through university. They studied psychology, I studied maths. And I'm not going to lie, we didn't actually talk that much about psychology. And I don't know why I didn't, because I'm very interested in it now. And it took me a long time to really get to grips with why I found it interesting. One of them also did a whole load of philosophy. I never asked her about it. And maybe that's not the coolest thing in the world to talk about when you're, I don't know, out having a drink or whatever. But I kind of regret that to some degree. And I wish I'd done a bit more of that. But again, it's the same thing. It's like, how can you try and, I guess, expand the boundaries a little bit of what it is that you're doing. And I know that that's hard when you've got exams and when you're trying to just get through your coursework and all that sort of thing. But even if it just means, like, I don't know, picking up one new magazine a month that you would never read before, or trying a new news website that you've never come across, it's in, I don't know, maybe you're a math student and maybe it's, this is all about architecture or something. I don't know, just trying, pick something else up and allow your mind to do all the weird connecting itself, because it will do that. That's literally what it's designed to do. And I think it's an interesting way of breaking out of what we assume we are meant to do, what we're allowed to do, and indeed what we're good at. So yeah, that would be my advice.
Well, Gemma, thanks very much for coming onto the show, and the best of luck in your PhD research. We look forward to hearing more about it in another episode.
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me, Joe. I really appreciate it.
Well, everybody, that's our episode for today. Thanks for coming along. I hope you're now primed to jump into the conversation about smoke and mirrors. Listen up for events in the STS One Book program. Very special thanks to Gemma Milne for coming along today. You can hear more from Gemma through lots of different channels. She co-hosts the Radical Science podcast, for example, and she has lots of journalism out there. Links to her main channels are in the show notes. Smoke and Mirrors is available just about everywhere. There also are a few YouTube films with Gemma talking about her ideas. Music today has featured two pieces by Kevin MacLeod. One was Roland at Five. Another was Sweet of Vermouth. Both are available through the website filmmusic.io. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you're wondering about our degrees, just get in touch. We're always happy to talk. Finally, you can find out more about the show, tell us what you think, and explore our programs just by visiting our website. Here's the address, so write it down. It's ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast. Well, that's it for today. Oh, it's so nice to be back with a new series. We have got a lot planned for the new series, so we'll meet here again soon. I can't wait. So until next time, everybody, I'm Professor Joe Kane, and thanks for listening. You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Join us online. The address? ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.